history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that need to be told, and we're always better off when we take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained. So often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This idea of capturing our veterans' memories while they're still here to share them is something that has really taken off in recent years. I've always felt that while we only bring you the story of one World War II veteran a week on Hometown Heroes, the hope is that some of you listening would be motivated to talk to the veterans in your life about what they did and what they went through. And I know it's happening. So many of you have shared really powerful stories of what those conversations have led to. And every once in a while, I get the chance here to introduce you to other individuals or organizations who are doing great work in this realm, and that's the case today. Whether you do it while you're listening to today's program or later, I hope you have some time to go online and check out picturesforheroes.org. I have it linked for you also at hometownheroesradio.com, but at picturesforheroes.org, you can find incredibly striking portrait-style photographs of dozens of World War II vets taken by a talented and dedicated young photographer named Zach Coco. Some of these photos have appeared in the LA Times. His efforts have been trumpeted by People Magazine and other media entities. And if you're a regular listener, you've heard me mention Pictures for Heroes every once in a while when our efforts have overlapped. It's not too often on this program that I can refer to somebody younger than myself, so I'm going to enjoy it while it lasts. The perspective that this young man has as the result of his interactions with World War II vets, I think, is really worth hearing. So I hope you'll listen closely as we get to know him, but also some of the men that he's photographed. I'm going to be referencing, and so will he, specific photos that you can find on his website, picturesforheroes.org. One of my personal favorites is a photo he took of Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley reading from the journal that Stu kept during his Navy days. The events of December 7th, 1941 are inscribed there in ink, and of course indelibly etched into the memory of this spirited sailor who was on the battleship USS West Virginia that fateful morning. Before we hear from Zach Coco about Pictures for Heroes, here's a taste of the kind of stories that are behind his photos. What a 20-year-old Stu Headley experienced at Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941.
When I reached for my hat, I got kicked right in the seat of the pants by a first-class bosun mate, Hicks. Get to your battle station on the double. This is the real thing. I grabbed my hat and ran on top sight. Planes are diving from every direction. And similar to this, a gun sets up off the deck. Mm-hmm. And it's all open underneath. I saw this pilot, Lieutenant White, shooting with his .45. Well, I dove under there with him. Now, I'm a seaman first class. He's a lieutenant commander, so I'm not going to question. But I'm thinking. And he says, son, where's your battle station? And I put it up to gun 3. He says, get up there as fast as you can. As I was going up the ladder to get in the turret, here come a Japanese torpedo plane down the port side. I could see the pilot, the radioman, and the co-pilot laughing like everything. I got inside the turret, and Krausen was already in the trainer's seat. Nobody was up on the gun deck, no shellmen or rammers or anybody. So I went down to my battle station. When I go out to the schools, I put on a little demonstration. I point out how the Lord protected me. When I was 9 years old, I used to like to sit in the chair and lean back on the back two legs. My dad only spoke twice. Third time he acted. And you, yes, sir, and no, sir, in our house. Mm-hmm. So I was in the kitchen, and I'm leaning back on the back two legs. My dad walked in. Stuart, they made four legs and a chair to sit on the floor. Yes, sir. But how quick a 9-year-old forgets. So next time I'm leaning back, my dad says, Stuart, I'll not tell you again. Yes, sir. In this ear and out that ear. So the next time I'm leaning back, my dad walked in the kitchen, kicked the bag leg out from underneath me. I cracked my head on the floor. I said, there's got to be a better way. Now you see my legs back up under. That's 9 years old, a habit that I learned. I'm now 20 years old, and I'm in my battle station. Normally, my feet would be on a platform. I would be bent over cranking in the dials for the elevation that they want that gun raised.
And this is a big 16-inch gun.
16-inch cannon.
How big are the projectiles in that?
It stands 5'2". It's 16 inches in diameter. They weigh 2,700 pounds. I called it a Volkswagen going out the barrel. And it takes 5 100-pound bags of black powder to hurl that shell from San Diego to Oceanside.
Uh-huh.
That is, if I've got that gun elevated to maximum height, that shell will fly 30 miles.
I just wanted people to have a sense of this isn't a little anti-aircraft gun. This
is the
biggest you got.
So now I'm in my battle position. But we're not going to fire these 16-inch guns in Pearl. We'll blow Pearl Harbor off the map.
Yeah.
And so consequently, my feet were back up underneath me. I'm on a high stool. No back. JA phones on. And we could hear the machine gun bullets hitting the turret. We felt the thud of a torpedo. And Krausen says, Stu, let's see what's going on. We took the sight cap off our periscope and bam, there went the Arizona. And I estimated there were about 32 bodies that flew through the atmosphere.
So I want people to understand what you're saying here. Because very few people actually saw the Arizona
explode.
They saw the aftermath. They saw the smoke, or they heard it and they turned.
We saw it.
You looked into this viewfinder right before the bomb hit.
And see, I immediately thought that a bomb went down this stack because it looked like the ship broke in half. When I met this fellow here, I found out the truth. Jack McCarran was one that was blown off the ship into the burning oil. But he later informed me that he had been informed that an armor-piercing shell went through the starboard side of the forecastle right into number one handling room. There's 1,000 bags of black powder in each one of the handling rooms. That exploded. That set off turret two. That's what broke the ship in half.
But you're a 20-year-old kid.
I'm a 20-year-old brat growing up overnight.
And you're looking at a ship just like yours, another battleship, blowing up and bodies flying through the air.
Yep.
How do you react to that?
Startled, surprised, but waiting for the next scenario.
Sure.
Because the next scenario was an armor-piercing shell dropped from a high-level bomber came through our turret. And what he'd done, he took 15-inch armor-piercing shells. Mm-hmm. They welded fins on them so that they would spiral. Well, over top of our left gun is a catapult, and I called it a slingshot. And we had two airplanes on that catapult that morning. One was a scout observation plane, an SOU-2, and the other was the Kingfish, the Admiral's plane. Well, the scout observation is a biplane.
Yeah.
The top wing is the gas tank. The Admiral's plane is a single wing. And when that shell hit, it hit the top wing of the scout plane. The gasoline exploded, burnt the plane to a crisp, split that catapult in half, and came down through 5 inches of steel right into the left gun. And the reason I'm here today is because that shell did not explode.
You can always access Stu Headley's entire story at hometownheroesradio.com, but please do take a look at the photo of Stu with his diary at picturesforheroes.org. And to understand more about the effort behind it, we bring in photographer Zach Coco to explain what Pictures for Heroes is and where it came from.
Pictures for Heroes is a legacy preservation project. It started after the death of my grandfather. He was a World War II Navy vet. So after he died, I realized that generation is leaving us pretty quickly. So I wanted to make it my mission to interview and photograph as many World War II veterans as possible to preserve their legacies for future generations to learn from.
So this is something you already had a skill for? You'd already been doing some photography? Or where did you get this idea? You know, still photographs of these guys in their 80s and 90s are going to be something that we can treasure.
Yeah, photography is my background professionally. I would study it in high school and college and currently work as a freelance photographer. So I took that skill set and combined it with, you know, interviewing these gentlemen to put a face with the story. So you have both aspects there.
And how did people react to that? I mean, when you told your family, your friends, what you wanted to do, what was some of the feedback you got?
It's been nothing but great response. I've learned a lot from doing it. History-wise, and I'm able to share that knowledge and those facts with my friends and family as well. So they're fascinated by the stories. I tell everybody it's like listening to a movie script every time I sit down with one of these veterans. So a lot of it is just unbelievable.
And you mentioned your grandfather as the inspiration, but if people were listening, they heard you say it was after he passed that you got this idea. So is that partly wishing you would have had the chance to do this with your grandpa?
Yeah, I'd always had the idea while he was still alive, and it's one of those instances where you don't necessarily seize the moment, and you don't realize what you have until it's gone. So I never took advantage of the time I had with him, and after he passed, it was sort of a light bulb went off, and I realized that time is running out, and these guys aren't going to be here forever.
Tell me about your grandpa a little bit. What was it about him that you appreciated, and what have you come to learn about his contribution to the war?
Well, I didn't necessarily know in depth his contribution during World War II. I know he was in the Navy. He served on the USS Rushmore. He was a fireman first class. And one of the small details I know is that his ship was hit by a torpedo, and luckily it glanced off the hull and never detonated. Otherwise, I may not be here today, but he was my hero growing up. He taught me a lot about being humble, working hard, do every job for somebody as if you were to do it for yourself. So he just taught me a lot of good moral life lessons that I carry on with me today.
And when you say that, you might not be here otherwise. Was there a point where that sank into you when you found out what had happened to his ship and how close they came to getting knocked out of the water, that it kind of sunk in, that sobering thought that, yeah, really, I would have never been born?
Absolutely. And it also, looking at it from a different perspective, there's a lot of people who never were born because of those 400,000 plus soldiers that lost their lives. They never had a chance to start families. They never had a chance to have children and grandchildren. So, you know, it's mind-boggling if you keep thinking about how deep and how widespread the results of the war actually are. Because they're still going on today. You just don't realize it.
So how long have you been doing this now?
I've been working on this project for about 3.5 years. And it's evolved, you know, a few times throughout that process, but I've gotten into a pretty good rhythm and interviewed about 70 World War II veterans up to this point.
Is what Pictures for Heroes has developed into now, is that what you set out to do, or is it a little different? Have you been surprised by some of the things that have unfolded or developed because you decided to take this step and go after this?
I'm definitely happy with where it is. My initial goal was to just get out and interview World War II veterans. Surprisingly, the photography aspect wasn't an initial thought, but I realized that I'm a photographer by trade, so I might as well implement that. And the main goal right now is to put a book together. So I'm working on a compilation book, which will consist of 100 World War II veterans portraits and biographies. Mm-hmm. So that's the mission I'm on right now.
When do you expect to have that book where people can order it?
I hope to have it out, published and printed by this time next year. That's the goal right now.
And when it is printed, some of those guys you photographed will still be around, and I'm sure it'll be a treasure on their coffee table. I'm sure there's some other guys that you've interviewed that are already gone. How have you handled that, getting to know these guys really at the end of their lives and probably sometimes right before they leave us?
Yeah, and unfortunately that is a reality of, you know, the field that we're in, and my goal is to get it out so those who are in the book can enjoy seeing the results. And You're absolutely right. A few have passed on already, and it's tough. You know, some you become closer to than others for, you know, no particular reason, but it hurts you. Every time I do an interview, it's almost like I get to spend another day with my grandfather. So every time I hear one of them passing, I feel that pain again. I feel for the families that lose their grandfather or father or, you know, whatever their relation is. But they appreciate having the information that we've captured, the photos that we've captured, and the interviews that we've captured, which I provide a copy of everything for the families so they have it. And that was the main goal initially, to provide that information for families so they can share it with their children and grandchildren, because I don't have that for my grandfather.
Give me an example of some of the things you've learned that you never would have learned otherwise if you weren't doing this, if you weren't going out and finding these guys and spending the time with them. What are some of the things that have been real eye-openers for you?
First thought that comes to mind is some of the tragedies that these guys lived through, specifically the Bataan Death March. I knew nothing about it initially. Those men were tortured and beaten and killed for no reason. And if they were lucky enough to survive the death march, they spent the next 3.5 years in a POW camp. And if they were lucky enough to survive that, they came out weighing under 100 pounds generally. And one gentleman in particular who actually just passed away over Memorial Day weekend, a few months shy of his 100th birthday, his name was Solomon Schwartz, and he survived all of that. But he came home with no malice in his heart. He forgave the day he got out of camp. And to be subject to that sort of treatment and to be able to forgive the people that put you through that, it's very inspiring. We hold grudges for very small things, the most mundane instances. So I carry that with me, and I try to live my life along those guidelines. It's not worth it.
Yeah, I imagine your perspective has been changed in a lot of ways by getting to know some of these folks and understand what they went through.
Yeah, I've been humbled a million times over, and my perspective on life has definitely changed. So I'm grateful for the country I live in and the freedoms I have today because of these men and women.
Powerful perspective from photographer Zach Coco of Pictures for Heroes. To see his photos of Saul Schwartz, that Bataan Death March survivor he mentioned, and dozens of other vets he spent time with, check out picturesforheroes.org. I have it linked for you as well at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll hear more from Zach as well as more veterans when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a chance today to not only hear some powerful stories from World War II veterans, but also explore another effort to celebrate those veterans and preserve those stories. Zach Coco is the photographer behind Pictures for Heroes, and you'll hear some more of those heroes in a moment. But let's get more from Zach. If you go to picturesforheroes.org and you click on the tab that says My Hero, you'll find a photo of Zach's grandfather, Anthony, a Navy veteran who Zach never had the privilege of interviewing about his World War II service. It was that feeling of missed opportunity, of unfinished business, that led Zach to start documenting vet stories.
Initially, you weren't thinking about taking the photographs. And, you know, there are a lot of people that are out recording veteran stories, and that's been neat over recent years to see how that's grown and how many more people are doing that. But you're kind of unique in what you're doing with these portrait style photographs of veterans, oftentimes in the uniforms that they wore during World War II. So did that kind of happen accidentally? Was it in the course of one of these interviews that that kind of clicked, hey, this is really neat and unique? Or how did that element of what you're doing evolve?
Initially when I set out, I had my brother helping me, and we were sort of running a more complicated setup that I couldn't do by myself. And his schedule didn't align with mine as often as I would have liked, so I said, I need to do this on my own. I need to find a way to make it work for me. And I realized I'm a photographer, so I should do photography and document visuals of these men and women. And I actually sort of initially put the interviewing aspect to the side, and then the idea for the book came about, and I realized that the pictures alone don't do these men and women justice. And the story alone is the same thing. So I think combined, I realized it was a necessity to have both and to put both of them together. So it was very quickly that I realized, probably after my fourth or fifth interview, that I realized this is the format that I need to follow. And as far as the portraits go, I try to craft each one for each individual. I do the interviews first so I can learn about their experiences. And I try to incorporate any uniform or artifacts that they may have. And all the portraits are usually conducted in the home, so they're comfortable in a familiar place for them.
Do you have a favorite photograph you've taken, or an image that just maybe really resonated with the veteran or his family or other people?
I do, and it seems to be the favorite of most people that I show the work to. I mean, it's actually the second portrait that I took. Was of a gentleman named Stanley Troutman, and he's 100 years old right now, and he was a war correspondent, so he's not actually a veteran, but he put himself in harm's way. He was in the Pacific covering the war for years and years. He actually volunteered to go with having a wife and a child back home at the time. So I connected with him because we have a photography background, but he also was the first American journalist into Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the bombs had been dropped. So all the initial images that came out were taken by him. And he was gracious enough to hand sign one of the original darkroom prints that he had taken. And so I have that, I treasure that forever. But the image is of him holding what looks like a gun, like a grenade gun, but it's actually a machine gun camera that the Japanese would use to train their machine gunners before they graduated to the real thing. So it's one of my favorite images, and it seems to be the favorite of a lot of other people as well. So,
and I'm guessing that before you started doing this, you had no idea something like that would exist or someone like him was out there.
Yeah, not in a million years. I mean, I met him on an honor flight trip, and he had his uniform on during the trip, and I just thought he had a really cool look. So I didn't know anything about him at the time, and I reached out to his daughter and asked if I could come and take some pictures of him. And then sitting down, he had an entire scrapbook, probably of 100 darkroom prints of his images throughout the war. So after sitting down and speaking with him, I learned of his history, and it blew my mind. So
do you look at his story and say, hey, maybe that's what I would have been doing 75 years ago?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, you never know. You never know. They're a different breed. Yeah, it's tough to compare myself to what those guys did.
And how old are you?
I'm currently 31.
So they were a lot younger than you are.
They were a lot younger.
They were doing these things.
And a lot braver. So,
does that ever just, I mean, you've done so many of these guys now, you've gotten to know so many of them, heard so many stories, but do you still feel that shock value, that awe when you realize, hey, here's a 17, 18, 19-year-old kid doing XYZ?
It definitely does, and it's tough to grasp that concept sometimes, because you're sitting across from an individual who's 90 plus years old, and when you hear of war and the duties of a soldier, you don't think of a teenager carrying those out, flying planes, jumping out of planes, you know, the various instances that they've had to, you know, storming the beaches of Normandy. And it doesn't sound like the job for a teenager, but they carried it out.
That they did. And when he said storming the beaches of Normandy, I couldn't help but think of E.T. Roberts, a 19-year-old from Oklahoma who landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day with the 29th Infantry Division, 115th Regiment.
We were to hit Omaha 820 D-Day with assisted assault, we were told. And they said there'd be bomb craters on the beach when we trained. And I trained with rifle and flamethrower, too. I had a flamethrower when I hit the beach. And I went off the ramp, and I never did touch bottom. And I turned the flamethrower loose. And I had a soldier behind me that had my full field pack. I had a lot of good stuff in my pack, in my bedding, my eats, and everything in that pack. And he had my rifle. He's supposed to go off the same time as me behind me, and as soon as I got rid of that flamethrower, give me my rifle and stuff and let me go. But I've never seen that boy yet today. I don't know whatever happened to all that crew, but I had turned that flamethrower loose. It's going to drown me. And the tide was so high, it come up under my helmet like it broke my neck. And I had to lay there on the beach until I got my neck straightened up. I crawled over and got a rifle from a soldier that was wounded there, or dead. I'm sure he's dead because I see his entrails and stuff laying out on the ground that were strapped on what I disintegrated him almost. Anyway, I got up on the beach and went up on the hill, and all I ever saw of my whole company was seven of us left. I don't know whatever happened to the rest. I've never seen them yet today. And then when we went into combat, I got wounded about 29 days after I got into combat at St. Lo. And I went out, and when I came back into combat, they didn't send me back to my company. They sent me back to 116th. And I went to Brest. And that was well fortified, and started taking soldiers up to the front and placing them and everything, and had a few problems. Got court-martialed and everything in there for telling the colonel that I was going to shoot him, but because he called me Yellow Belly, he told me to move up some soldiers 700 yards, and I moved up the squad to 700 yards, and I went back in a little bit to check them. He said, come back and report it when you get a place. I went back and reported it, and then I went back up. There were seven of them dead, and one that I kind of thought quite a bit of. He was laying there, and his leg was blown off. He just had it laid up over his head. And he said, Sergeant, he said, take this leg off of me. And I called to hold his sock. There wasn't no shoes. Shoes was blown off. And I broke down and went back and kind of give the lieutenant a piece of my mind. He didn't like it, and he sent me to the company CP, which just a little ways back there. And I went back, and I threatened the lieutenant colonel back there that, when he called me Yellow Belly, he said, well, what's about that? He said, that you Yellow Belly? And I said, no, you're the Yellow Belly. Being back here, I ought to go out there and get my gun. I had my gun sitting outside of the tent that he was in. And I said, I should shoot you. So I got court-martialed, busted from staff sergeant down to private, which I didn't care. I mean, stripes is nothing. There wasn't nothing else but to get that over with and get home. So I finished up all the way through with the 116th Infantry. Went to Belgium, Holland, all the way back to Germany. We finished the job anyway, and that's what I'm proud of today, that we did finish our job.
Yeah, and you were in on the beginning of it, at least in Europe. And you just gave us a great overview of your whole experience there. And I know it's not easy to talk about all of it, but I want to ask you a few more questions about that. As you're heading toward Omaha Beach, and you're on that landing craft, I imagine the big picture of everything you could see in every direction was something that you've never seen again since. What did it look like as you were approaching that beach?
When I was sitting out there, we were hit June 5th. We were supposed to hit the 5th. And the tide was so high that we couldn't go in. We had to sit out there. And you could step from ship to ship that was taking soldiers in there, and you couldn't see nothing across that ocean as far as you could see with ships and stuff going in to make the invasion in there. And we went in the next June 6th, the next day. All of us was so sick, seasick. But, when you say ramp down, you got to get off. You can't turn back. You got to go. So we had to go. And when you hear people today say, I'm sick, I can't go to work, think about something like that and see how that fix. When they dump you off over there seasick and nothing to eat, we had to stay out there days longer than we had to, and the boat was full of vomit and stuff that way. It really was. It was a mess. So that's what we went through with. And then it was 9 days before we ever got any good clothes to put on. We hit that salt water and stuff. You can imagine what our feet and stuff was.
And I want to ask you, as you hit that water, you described for us having that flamethrower on, and this is a big, heavy thing that you're going to wear on your back, 72 pounds of equipment there, and you come off that ramp, you're expecting your feet are going to hit bottom, but you just kept sinking?
Well, they told us and said, unbuckle your chin straps because the tide will come up under your helmet. And I didn't unbuckle my chin strap. The flamethrower I thought would help me too, but the flamethrower is what took me down so fast that tide came up under and hurt my neck, like broke my neck, I guess. And since I came home in civilian life, I'd had two discs replaced in my neck and everything.
It's not exaggerating to say that you nearly died just coming off the landing craft.
Oh, sure. Sure, I'm lucky to be here today. People could never, I can't even understand myself how I ever lived through the smoke and gunfire. He said you couldn't hear nothing. It was the smoke, it was strangly, it was so thick, gun smoke. Just shell after shell and big facing a cannon sitting inside of a wall that was firing out there and nothing. I saw little LCVPs come in there, not one soldier get off of it. That shell, the way they had it, big, the gun emplacement, they said had 4 foot of cement in it and sitting in the walls, just like going into a side of a house and look out the windows. The gun placements looked like that to me. I could see them firing all out of there. I told the guy on the Marine or sailor, whatever he was on the ship, I said, open fire on him. Open fire on that guy there. He was so scared he run off the top. Not on where he ever went to. That's when we was going in. I could see that firing was taking place there. But when I got out on the beach and I got straightened up and got up off of the beach, I met about 7 people from the same company I didn't know, even hardly. Got me a rifle and stuff and went on through there. And then I got wounded in St. Louis. I got changed from first scout to a squad leader, and we were completely replaced 9 times. So when they start to ask me, telling me names and stuff, I finally got to where I'm just going to call you soldier. And that's about the way I think today. People tell me names, and I can't think of names. I think of stuff like that so many names came and said, well, this is so-and-so, this so-and-so, and maybe 30 minutes he'd be not there. I've seen him last about 30 minutes in combat, and that's about it.
Certainly there on June 6th, and it's been called the longest day for a really good reason, especially the part of it you were in.
I couldn't get off of there. I was sick and had to lay there, and I got my neck straightened up, and that water was solid blood. I mean, it was just like a bloodbath going through it there. The beach, you couldn't walk without stepping on a dead soldier. You crawled and made your way around through there to get off of the beach, and finally I did. Got off the beach. I don't know. Some people say, how long did it take you to get off the beach? I don't know. And I don't think anybody else would. There's so much going on and everything that you couldn't even tell anybody your name, probably.
His name is E.T. Roberts, and what a vivid picture he paints of June 6, 1944. Imagine living with all of that for all these years. And one of the things I love so much about the photos Zach Coco produces through Pictures for Heroes is that I'm always drawn to the eyes of the veteran. Sometimes it's as if you can feel the weight of the history that they've lived through as you look at their nonagenarian eyes. If you take some time to explore picturesforheroes.org, you'll find that E.T. Roberts is not only featured as all the other veterans there are, but if you click on the About tab, you'll see the photo Zach Coco has chosen to go along with the information about him and his project is one of him with that D-Day survivor you just heard from, E.T. Roberts. Again, I have all of this linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we're going to get some more thoughts from Zach Coco on what photographing all these World War II vets has meant in his life. And how you can help his efforts if you're so inclined. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a little different twist today, but one that personally has been really refreshing for me. Hearing a 31-year-old professional photographer talking about how his interactions with World War II veterans have changed his life and changed his perspective, it's encouraging. We're going to hear more from Zach Coco of Pictures for Heroes in a moment, and I hope you will go over to picturesforheroes.org if you haven't already. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you'll recognize some of those faces, like Harpo Salaya, who survived the sinking of the USS Indianapolis, like the incredible Robert Thacker, who was flying into Pearl Harbor on the morning of December 7th, 1941, and survived to become a record-breaking aviator. Zach's photo of him is one of my all-time favorites. You'll see P-38 pilot Don Stoutenborough, and the one and only Bob Izumi, a Japanese-American veteran who found his way out of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team and into the 101st Airborne during World War II. And you'll see an amazing photo with a red-tailed P-51 Mustang in the background, and in the foreground, the inimitable smile of Lieutenant Colonel Robert Friend, one of the last surviving members of the 332nd Fighter Group, a segregated group of African-American pilots and support crews who had trained in Tuskegee, Alabama, and thus became known as the Tuskegee Airmen. Bob Friend has been an incredible ambassador for the Tuskegee Airmen, and at the start of his long, decorated career in aviation, he flew 142 World War II missions in P-51s.
Yes, 142 missions in the 15th Air Force. I flew some sorties in the 12th Air Force when we were flying a completely different aircraft with it for a completely different mission.
Help me understand what it was like to be you at that time, because my understanding is your whole role in your squadron was one of someone who was somewhat expendable. You guys are there to protect these bombers. It means, well, if someone's going to go down, it's going to be you guys, I suppose. Did you feel like the first line of defense?
Well, we were that. There's no doubt about that. And certainly the objective was to allow that bomber to do its mission. And certainly, yes, we were the buffer. But strangely enough, they didn't concentrate on us nearly as much as they did on trying to get the bombers down. So it was fairly easy, as a rule, to chase them off. Don't get me wrong. They would get through sometime because they'd get above and start a dive and just dive straight through. It's almost like suicide. You're going to get caught and picked up after, not before he gets there. But they, too, had an objective, and that was protect their homeland.
And they had a variety of different planes. At the end of the war, they had planes that were faster and superior to even the one you were flying. Did you ever engage any of those ME-262s?
Yes, I met a 262, and strangely, I met him head-on. And I didn't realize we were going head-on. I thought first that I was overtaking him. The silhouette looked the same. But then when I saw the guns firing, I knew that we were coming toward each other. And we went right past.
when I turned around, he was gone.
That's one of those you don't even figure out what it was till it's gone, huh?
Well, dogfights are funny. It can be going on, you know, rather heavily, and then all of a sudden there's nothing. Everybody's gone. Some people took off for home, others, and it was important for us not to go chasing after them, because if you did, you left the bombers open to secondary attacks.
I thought that was a dynamic that was well depicted in the George Lucas film, Red Tails, that aspect of, hey, you got to stick to the plan, not be going for the glory and chasing down a fighter. Was that ever a temptation of yours to go after one of those German planes?
Well, you know, it's like once you get locked on to him, you know, you don't want to let go. But we had some well-grounded discipline, and that was don't be drawn off.
Where did that come from?
The commander. Colonel Davis was a man that had a tough job. What he had to do was to take people who were relatively raw. All of us, how far much more experience could you say one had? You know, guy graduated in first class, guy graduated a month later in second class. And he, from these people, had to take people for, or identify people for key positions. Squadron commanders, group operations officers, squadron operations officers, maintenance officers, you know. And he had to get the right guy. Best of all, he recognized when he had made a mistake with a guy, and he made the change right away. He did not mess around.
That's leadership for you. With all those missions, I'm sure you had plenty of close calls. But is there one for you that when you think back on, you feel like, you know, God was really looking out for me on that one?
Yes. We had some of those. I had a barge explode, and I flew through all that debris. Got through okay. And the ones that, not direct, but it happens. When on one mission, the fellow that was going to lead the mission said, "Who's flying Charlie today?" Charlie was the last position in the squadron.
Tail and Charlie.
So I said, "I'm flying Charlie." So he said, "Well, let's switch airplanes. Mine's a newer airplane, and Charlie has a lot more activity, you know, staying in formation and so forth. So you take that and I'll fly yours." He never came back. The airplane quit on him.
So that would have been you in the airplane that quit.
Yes. And other instances when attacking a ground target, you can see the rounds coming. And actually, you can do things about it. If it looks like it's going to hit you, you're okay, because it goes like this. But if it looks like it's going by in front, be careful. You better change something, change speed, change direction, change something, because it was pretty much hanging on to you then.
I'm sure you found plenty of bullet holes in your planes, but with stuff like that, with that anti-aircraft fire coming at you, what's the closest it actually came to hitting you? You personally, I mean your body, not your plane.
I never came close to being hit. I know that there were friends who had rounds go through the cockpit. You know, one guy, the first aid kit was behind your back. Took the first aid kit out. Another one, the round died just as it got there, and it stayed stuck in his windshield. Yeah.
Close enough.
Yes.
How much did you enjoy the plane you were flying? For people that haven't experienced that airplane, what was it like for you?
That airplane, the P-51, absolutely so far ahead of its time. It really can be said that it swung the war. It swung the things in our direction without question. And as far as the pilots feel, I didn't feel like I climbed into an airplane. I felt like I put it on. I wore it.
And the look on your face says you wouldn't mind wearing it again, that you would go out there right now if there was one out here on the tarmac.
I certainly would love to. Yeah, I know that people think I'm a little too old for that, but I don't think you ever forget some things, and that's one of them. They've let me fly the airplane sometime after we got up, and I fly it okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's important to tell the story of the Tuskegee Airmen? What's the value of that for us today in knowing what you guys did and what you went through?
Well, I think the most important aspects of it is not to let it happen again. We don't need it again. I think that all you have to do is look at the relationship to the people at events like this. Much different. Much different. Some people, these people that you would probably never have had words for. What do you say? I know that the country itself has just absorbed so much in the way of the business and race relations. I feel that we should not even bother with considerations about race. I'm not saying that people should be not like their heritage. I like mine. I'm proud of my heritage. You know? But I don't think that it should be something that we say African-American, Indian-American, Mexican-American, Latin-American, German-American, Canadian-American. Who needs that? You're an American or you're not?
What an American he is. Tuskegee Airman Bob Friend, still going strong at age 98. You've got to see Zach Coco's photo of him at picturesforheroes.org or pull it up at hometownheroesradio.com. And let's get some final thoughts from Zach about Pictures for Heroes and find out how the rest of us can support his efforts.
What are some of the surprising things that you've seen unfold? Maybe the way people reacted to something or exposure that your project has gotten, or just some unexpected things that you couldn't have possibly foreseen when you started out with that first interview?
I think the one thing that has kind of reassured me that, you know, I'm doing something good for others is the gratitude that I've received from the families and even the veterans themselves. I conducted an interview and the gentleman just kept telling me, he said, "I can't believe this. I can't believe, you know, all this is happening." And it's hard for me to realize that because he deserves that appreciation. He deserves that respect and admiration. And it really touches me that somebody is that grateful just to have somebody come and spend a few hours with them. Yeah, I think they're the greatest generation, but they're also a forgotten generation at this point for the most part. You know, they're not out in public very much. They're generally secluded to their homes or place of residence. So, yeah, if you can seek them out and just have a conversation with them, it'll make their day.
Well, and I'm thinking there are a lot of young photographers who can work really hard to try to get their photos in a certain exhibition or in a certain publication. And I don't know how much of that has happened for you in your career outside of this. But, I mean, did you expect to have your work in People magazine when you started doing this?
No, not at all.
I know that wasn't your aim, but isn't that kind of a cool added bonus?
It definitely is, and, you know, not to benefit myself at all, but I think it's great that they're covering a topic that can sort of connect with younger people with the World War II generation, and I think it's great. And, yeah, definitely wasn't anticipating it, but love that they grasped the concept and sort of ran with it.
And if you were trying to get photos published in that, I mean, you could try 100 times and submit 100 photos, and you never know if it's going to happen. But when you're doing something for others and that just kind of happens as a result of it, that probably makes it a lot more satisfying.
It definitely does. And, you know, initially when I sought this project out, it was never the idea of doing something for me. It was always the idea of doing something for others. And it makes more of a difference in your life than you could imagine. You know, I think we all struggle sometimes with finding a direction, career, life, and we feel lost at times. And I always suggest to my friends and people I'm close with, just do something for somebody else. You put a small smile on their face, you change their day, and it'll come back to you. But if you do that repeatedly, it'll change your life, and definitely will.
So if someone's hearing this, and they say, "Hey, my dad or my grandpa has got a killer story, and I want you to come photograph him before he's gone," or maybe they want to help you with what you're doing and help make it possible to keep going, how can they get involved? How can they get in touch with you?
Well, they can visit our website, which is www.picturesforheroes.org. We're also on Facebook under that same name and on Instagram as well. So yeah, if anybody has a World War II veteran that they'd like to have interviewed, we're always looking for more. So please reach out. You can also email us at info@picturesforheroes.org.
And you mentioned that once you have 100, that book's going to be completed, and you hope that's about a year from now in 2019. But what about after that? How long are you going to keep doing this?
I intend to keep interviewing World War II veterans until the last one is gone. The book is just sort of a vehicle to share the information, but my main priority is getting the content. So if I have to put the book off in order to get more interviews done, then I will do so. But yeah, I intend to do this as long as I can.
When that book comes out next year with all these sharp, high-resolution photos of guys in their 90s reliving their teens and 20s and this crazy time in the world, if your grandpa were flipping through the pages, what do you think he'd think?
Well, I would hope he would be proud.
Anything else you want to say about him?
Just that he was a great man. He always told me you gotta laugh, and I carry that with me every day, try to make other people laugh, try to keep a smile on my face. So yeah, I miss him.
And I know so many of us listening to those words are thinking about the veterans we find ourselves missing. I'm going to go ahead and imagine my World War II veteran grandpa throwing a wink and a smile in the direction of Zach's grandpa. And I hope you were touched by what we heard today. Maybe you were even inspired or motivated to take action on an idea that's been stirring inside of you for a while. You definitely won't regret taking a few minutes to explore those photos at picturesforheroes.org. If you're on social media, follow Zach's efforts there too so you can see each new veteran he photographs as those important meetings take place. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.